Our next speaker is Dr. Maya Ababu. She is here from Mass General, and she is a neurosurgeon that takes care of both adult and pediatric patients. And I think these topics she's going to speak about, clearing the cervical spine and head CTs, are something that we constantly wrestle with, and would love some clarity from the neurosurgeons on when and how to do this properly.
Great, thank you. All right, so I'll start out by talking about clearance of the pediatric cervical spine. And I think in general, and this addresses one of the questions or points made earlier, this is really meant to be, you know, what patient populations can we think about avoiding a scan or minimizing a scan? We're obviously not talking about any gray areas here. As I'll mention in a future slide, I think especially when we're talking about the pediatric cervical spine, there are so many congenital bony anatomy issues and anatomical variations that I think if there's any question, having a pediatric spine surgeon, either neurosurgeon or orthopedic surgeon, look at those imaging findings is very important and should certainly not be something that you feel you are entirely responsible for. Obviously, we are always worried about GCS and, as a proxy, whether the patient, the child in this case, is obtunded, is able to provide a neurologic assessment that's reliable or is not. And certainly age will determine what level of a neurologic exam we will be able to perform. I'm not going to go over the specific neurologic exams based upon the age of the child. Just for the purposes of this talk, focus on the imaging aspects, but obviously a higher fidelity exam as you have a child who's of a higher age. So I wanted to review guidelines that neurosurgery had published for the management of pediatric cervical spine and spinal cord injuries. These were published back in 2013, and I think are helpful in general. In terms of a level one diagnostic recommendation, CT was recommended to determine a condylar C1 interval injury or fracture in pediatric patients with a potential atlanto-occipital dislocation. So what does that mean? You get an initial cervical spine x-ray, lateral, and you see a gap between the skull base and the cervical spine. Again, there are some issues in terms of pediatric anatomical variation, but in general, if there's a concern about widening of that space between the skull base and the cervical spine, CT imaging does help tease apart whether this is a fracture versus or injury versus an anatomic variation. I would say in general, before you make this decision, oftentimes a pediatric spine surgeon is consulted or at least curbsided to help make this determination. Level two, this is a diagnostic recommendation again. Cervical spine imaging is not recommended in children who are greater than 3 years of age and who have experienced trauma and who are alert, have no neurologic deficit, have no midline cervical tenderness, no painful distracting injury, no unexplained hypotension, and are not intoxicated. Cervical spine imaging is not recommended in children who are less than 3 years of age, have a GCS greater than 13, no neurologic deficit again, no midline tenderness, no painful distracting injury. The mechanism is also important. So for instance, children who are involved in a motor vehicle accident, a fall from a significant height greater than 10 feet, or a non-accidental trauma or suspected non-accidental trauma should have a higher threshold of suspicion in terms of imaging and follow-up imaging. Now, cervical spine radiographs, plain films, AP and lateral, or high-resolution CT recommended for children who do not meet the criteria above. Certainly, if there's any sort of distracting injury or you have a high threshold for suspicion, our belief is that imaging would be helpful in these patients. A level three diagnostic recommendation essentially what I would say we do is an initial screen, which is the AP and lateral cervical spine x-ray. to assess the cervical spine in children less than 9 years of age. And I do want to point out, too, because these guidelines were published in 2013, and obviously the review of the data at that point was all prior to that, they use CT interchangeably with cervical spine radiographs in some of the language. But that's understanding that as the technology evolves and more centers have access to MRI and quicker access to MRI, MRI of the cervical spine certainly can be used. Again, our goal is to avoid as much as possible radiation dosing in the child. We get asked about flexion extension x-rays, so I'll just make mention of that. Flexion extension or fluoroscopy, real-time, flexion extension imaging, is recommended to exclude gross ligamentous instability when you have a suspicion of this. But again, in terms of what we're talking about for this group, the children that we can avoid further imaging in, we're kind of talking about, I would say, almost bread and butter cases where you have an alert, awake child, you can get a reliable exam, no distracting injuries. I think once you start thinking about ligamentous injury and are having a higher index of suspicion, then a subspecialist should certainly be involved. MRI is obviously recommended if there is a concern about the cord, any nerve root impingement or compression, and to evaluate for ligamentous injury. And I do want to make mention too, in the child there's a tremendous amount, and you folks would know this, in any body system there's a lot more laxity in terms of the tissues. And in particular, when we talk about ligamentous injury, you'll see things on MRI that light up, the anterior longitudinal ligament, for instance, in the spine. But whether this is something that warrants, certainly surgical intervention versus observation, I think our field is moving away from considering purely ligamentous injuries operative in general, and pursuing instead a strategy of observation. I would say that these rarely become operative. And it's interesting, as our imaging improves with MRI being used, we're able to pick up on these findings a lot more. But I will say, in terms of phone calls, we get a lot of follow-up phone calls. We still see a signal abnormality on MRI. Is this something that the child needs, further surgical intervention for? So this is a treatment recommendation, and I only put this in here. We all are familiar with cervical spine collars, immobilization as treatments. And again, this is a little bit dated insofar as, it mentions halo immobilization, and I know certain centers are moving away from that, especially in the pediatric patient population. But in general, the recommendation, I would say, is that if there is a true injury, you're able to confirm this. Initially, there's a screening suspicion based upon AP and lateral x-rays. You move to a CT, again, with consultation with a pediatric spine surgeon. Then you have the options, before you. Certainly, having the child properly immobilized in the field, pre-hospital transfer is very important with cervical spine immobilization. And when in doubt, please leave the child in that cervical spine collar. The child will be uncomfortable, but I think until we get definitive imaging, that's the best thing you could do to help minimize any potential for injury. So can MRI be used effectively? So I just wanted to highlight, this is a paper that looked at essentially a chart review of trauma patients at a level one trauma center. And the patient population was young people less than 18 years of age, had a normal C-spine CT scan, but then subsequently had a C-spine MRI. So there were 173 patients who met the inclusion criteria. So 100% of these patients had a normal C-spine CT. 83% had also negative findings on MRI. So there's a little bit of discordance. So what was interesting is you had some significant abnormalities in 17% of patients on MRI. And so of the 30, five required operative C-spine stabilization. So these results were somewhat mixed in terms of the results suggest that a high-resolution CT, and again, I appreciate what you had mentioned earlier in terms of the advancement over time with CT scan, not only with dosing, but in terms of our ability to have reconstructions and the fidelity of the CT scan for detecting abnormalities has improved over this window as well. But essentially having sagittal coronal views as well as axial reconstructions can actually be comparable to MRI in terms of helping assess for unstable spine, C-spine injuries that may warrant surgical intervention. Again, hopefully at most pediatric trauma centers, access to an MRI in a timely fashion is, I think, becoming more common. But in situations where this can't occur, you know, obviously a CT with appropriate reconstructions is the best thing that can be ordered to help facilitate the process. And we certainly don't want to subject the child to multiple scans. And then this is just a Cochrane database review looking at triage for detecting cervical spine injury in the pediatric patient. So I thought this was interesting. They looked at, you know, Nexus criteria and the CCR, the Canadian C-spine rule, just to see if these tools may or may not be helpful in terms of pediatric patients. Using these tools that have been sort of proved in an adult population for a pediatric population. And so ultimately, there was not enough evidence to determine the accuracy to actually determine whether there were C-spine injuries in a pediatric trauma patient population using these kind of well-established frameworks. So I think more can be done. But I would also, emphasize the point that because there are more congenital variations in the pediatric population, I prefer more distance from the adult guidelines than I would from just saying that you could use Nexus or you could use some of these others, because I think it increases right from the get-go your threshold for suspicion and your, willingness to phone a friend and see if a pediatric spine surgeon can also assess the images if there's any concern. This is from the Trauma Association of Canada. It may be hard to see, but I just wanted to kind of walk through. This is an algorithm that just shows, I think, in terms of practice, how you can think through managing these patients. So the first step is, are you able to clinically clear the C-spine? So meaning, are all those parameters met? You have an alert child, you know, non-intoxicated, the child doesn't have distracting injuries, et cetera, et cetera. If yes, you can clear the spine clinically, you can remove the collar. If no, if the child's cooperative, you move to the left arm, which gives us the options of, if the child's cooperative, to try to get as many plain film x-ray views as possible. AP lateral, odontoid can be helpful, but the AP and lateral, I think, will give you an initial indication of if there's a potential for concern. Uncooperative, again, you're talking about the same imaging. If you can get a neurologic exam, then if it's abnormal, you certainly want to leave the collar on. You want to, at that point, try to get an MRI if available at your institution. If not, I would say consult the spine service at that point. If the exam is normal, then you move to the left-hand side again. If it's normal and you have an adequate x-ray, you're able to get plain films. If the plain films are normal and the child is less than 8 years of age, there's a question of planning head CT. So that has to do with if you're looking at head injuries, which we'll talk about separately. So I'll avoid this arm in particular. But the issue here is that if you see an injury with the C-spine, obviously your threshold for concern for head injury should be higher. If the child is greater than 8 years of age, then you get back into this parameter here where you start with re-examination to try to make a clinical assessment. And there are several pathways from which this pathway emerges. Now, if the normal and adequate x-rays, actually the x-ray shows an abnormal finding, that's when you get to the point of considering a CT of the C-spine. And certainly you want to leave the collar on, and I would say at that point you want to consult a subspecialist. But I think this gives you a pretty clear exam or a framework. Bottom line, if you have a child who's able to give you an exam, who doesn't have a distracting injury, non-intoxicated, and you can clinically clear that child, I think you can get AP and lateral x-rays and then take the next steps in terms of discontinuing the collar. When in doubt, I would say the child's a candidate for CT, and then you'd consult a spine surgeon. And then this essentially kind of summarizes what we just talked about. Again, a lot is dependent upon the neurologic exam. If it's abnormal, leave the collar on, please. If the exam is normal, then you can get your anterior views, AP and lateral x-ray views. And then, as was mentioned previously as well, if there's any concern at all, you can observe the patient, the child, for 24 to 72 hours. If it's an issue with reliability of exam, et cetera, leave the child in the collar. And eventually, if you can get an exam, obviously terrific. If not, then I think that gives you a little bit of time to reread or overread the x-rays. So I'm going to move in quickly to when should a head CT be obtained in the pediatric patient? I would say, in general, our philosophy is avoidance as best we can. Obviously, fast MRI is terrific. Clinical observation in certain patient populations when possible. So I just wanted to highlight this study that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Kupperman et al., 2009, The Lancet. You know, again, in talking about which patient populations can we stratify, I think low-hanging fruit in terms of avoiding even the discussion of head CT is children with mild head injuries, children and adults, to be honest, with mild head injuries. So what does that mean? GCS at least 14, 15 in this study. You know, technically we think of 13 as being part of the mild head injured category. But in this paper in particular, a child with a GCS of 14 or greater, or other signs of altered mental status or a palpable skull fracture, you know, in this case, you know, we have two pathways here. If this doesn't describe the child, you have the occipital or parietal, I'm not sure if you can read this here. If this is not true of the child, you have occipital or parietal temporal scalp hematoma, so any scalp hematoma, or a history of a loss of consciousness, or a severe mechanism of injury, meaning a high-speed motor vehicle accident, or the child's just not acting normally. If that's the case, then I think your threshold for suspicion is quite high in terms of wanting to assess the patient. Observation, and you know, this study actually I think gives a little bit more wiggle room in terms of physician experience, et cetera. But I think in this child, head imaging is very appropriate. A fast MRI if at all possible, but certainly a CT if your threshold for suspicion is high. I think if the GCS is less than 14, you have signs of altered mental status and a skull fracture that's palpable, certainly considering a CT is very appropriate in that child, especially in terms of acute trauma. Now, if you're talking about a child who has, again, a poor GCS, so we're not talking about a mild, you know, head injured child, signs of altered mental status or evidence of a basilar skull fracture, which again suggests that there might be other injuries because those are high force, high velocity mechanism injuries, then in that population, yes, CT is most often recommended. If there is a history of a loss of consciousness, vomiting, a severe mechanism of injury, or the child has a severe headache, I guess if you have a good enough exam, I would say in this patient population, we tend to be talking about children who are very obtunded, intubated by this point, et cetera. Then, you know, if you have this history or concern, I think obviously observation versus a CT scan is very important. If not, and you have a reliable exam, then a CT is not recommended. So I would say bottom line, the take-home point is if a child has a GCS of 14, 15, which means you feel like you have a reliable neurologic exam, you have the opportunity to avoid any distracting injuries which might limit your ability to examine that child, and the mechanism of injury, meaning it's not a high-speed motor vehicle accident, not a fall from a significant height, meaning greater than at least 10 feet, certainly there's wiggle room in that height, then in that case, you may consider clinical observation if you don't have a child who's had a loss of consciousness that's been documented, emesis in the field, etc. Now, this becomes tricky, and I think certainly the threshold of suspicion and the clinical suspicion, that's why this is worded in a way that it gives more credence to physician experience and oversight. When in doubt, obviously a fast MRI is preferred, but a head CT should not be shied away from. So I hope that that's clear, because it's hard. You know, you want to avoid scanning a child, but I would say, especially in the context of head injury, if you have the concern, scanning a child with a quick head CT is very, very appropriate, especially in instances where you see evidence of a basilar skull fracture on X-ray or you have any other injuries, especially in the cervical spine. So I won't get into these other instances because I think that these are evolving and I think certainly should involve consultation with your neurosurgery colleagues. But there's some evidence about smaller epidural hematomas, trying to observe them with serial imaging. Again, not germane, I think, to our discussion, but certainly something that we would recommend that you get specialist input. And children who may present with a coagulopathy, either inherited or have evidence of coagulopathy when they present. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yes.
Yes. So I think it's dependent upon a couple things. I think in general, and again, it varies in terms of if you're talking about a spine surgeon versus not. I think in general, our thought is to try to minimize, as much radiation as possible. Now, if you have abdominal injuries and you're getting a pan scan, I'm not talking about those situations. I'm talking about any concern for an isolated neck injury or head and neck. As you know, anytime there's a concern for a head injury, we often get head neck imaging at a minimum, CT. I would say, and this is again where there's a little bit of wiggle room, I think we always feel more comfortable with the CT scan, but if you're trying to avoid it with mechanisms of injury that are not a high-speed motor vehicle accident, not something that's going to increase your threshold of suspicion, I think it's appropriate to start with a AP and lateral X-ray to begin with, assuming it's an isolated injury. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
What injury do you consider not distracting? That's all the discussion.
What is not distracting? Yeah, that's an excellent question, yes, because, I mean, we're talking about trauma patients, so they're going to have other issues more than likely. No, that's a very good question. I think it's incredibly hard with a child in particular. A child is fussy, hungry, et cetera. You're not clear, is it, a distracting injury that's causing the child to be fussy, angry, or is it, related to what you think is their primary injury? I think it's hard, and I think I would say it depends very much in terms of the age of the patient. So, certainly you can stratify either, greater than 2 years of age, less than 2 years of age, as that study did. I think if you have clinical comfort that, you're palpating, for instance, the C-spine, you're, looking for hematomas, for instance, bruises, anything like that, and you don't see the child, wincing or guarding, I would say assuming that you have a child who's mostly cooperative, not crying, not fussy, et cetera, ideally able to communicate and verbalize, so we're talking about, I would say, older children right there, you have a better sense of whether there's a distracting injury. But I think you raise a good point. It's hard because you're not sure if the child is fussy or angry or not complying, and it's related to perhaps something else that's going to limit your ability to get a clinical exam, or if it's related to, the nature of the child, and something, being stimulated by various people, et cetera. I'm not sure if I answer. I don't think there's a good answer. Is the best answer I have for you. I think it's based upon clinical judgment. As everything really is, but any other questions? Yes, yes, ma'am.
So I heard you a lot of times saying to get a spine specialty.
Yes.
Consult.
Yes. Right. Yeah, and that's a good point. I think, obviously, each institution varies in terms of your accessibility to subspecialty colleagues. And, you know, I understand that there's resource issues there and you're trying to minimize resources in general. Yes, I think that would be helpful. And the only reason I say that in terms of trying to move up when a spine specialist is consulted, there are so many congenital anomalies that prompt further imaging. And if your institution is very focused, you know, and tracks the number of children who undergo CT scans and is trying to target, you know, either a significant decrease, et cetera, I think that's an opportunity. If you can get the subspecialist involved early on to say, okay, yes, this is an anomaly versus no, this warrants further imaging. I think it depends a lot on your institution and how well you track these numbers. Because for some places, you know, this is something that's tracked. We're trying to minimize it actively. How do we put our heads together and do this? And in that situation, the resource issue may not be as big of an issue if you try to get more consults than not. I don't know if I answered your question, but I think you raise a valid point. It's difficult, and each institution has different access to imaging resources, but also subspecialty resources. But I think in general, at least with our practice, is we want to be involved sooner rather than later, so that we can help make that assessment and at least be able to follow the patient, you know, with the team, hopefully, and avoid imaging if at all possible.
I have one just practical C-spine clearance question that comes up all the time at Children's Hospital. So, closed head injury, intubated down in either in the trauma bay or at the scene, gets a head scan and a CT scan, you know, in the trauma bay of the C-spine.
Yeah.
The C-spine CT scan is totally normal.
Yeah.
The next day, the child still doesn't have an exam, still intubated. Given the sophistication of the CT scans now, are you comfortable clearing the collar with just a totally normal CT scan, or do you recommend further imaging such as MRI?
With a closed head injury.
With a closed head injury, intubated, yeah. you can't get a neuro exam.
Yeah.
So how do you clear the collar?
That's a great question. So I think most folks would say try to get an MRI if at all possible in that situation. Assuming you can't,
the question to me is,
right.
We can always get the MRI.
Right.
My question really is about the sensitivity of the new CT scanners that are totally normal. Usually they're going to have some sort of edema if you have a ligament
Correct,
injury.
Right.
You know, are you comfortable clearing it with the new CT scanners versus...
So to answer that directly, yes. We would be comfortable clearing in that situation where you have no abnormal findings on CT, a closed head injury, and an obtunded patient intubated. I think CT alone, you're absolutely right. I think the fidelity of CT alone is great. I think you'll still see a lot of institutions move to MRI just as kind of a belt and suspenders move. But we haven't tried to systematically publish our data, but we are doing that clinically. So
thanks.
Yes.
We only have 1 minute, but I was going to ask you: has fast MRI replaced repeat head CT in your institution? And when do you get that if you have a documented
initial
head CT?
Yes, it has. So we try to do fast MRI whenever we can. And in terms of repeat head imaging, if a child has intracranial blood products on their first scan, assuming it's a CT or hopefully a fast MRI, but a CT, 4 to 6 hours, and then subsequently we typically, assuming that the amount of blood is stable to slightly, expected evolution, slightly enlarged, we manage the patient clinically. So we get one repeat scan. Again, if there's an expanding hematoma, anything that's concerning, it would either be a surgical case or followed with repeat imaging, but 4 to 6 hours in a fast MRI.
Awesome, thanks. I just want to thank all the audience for their participation. You know, as surgeons, we're always on time, so we're going to end this right on time at 9:30. Thanks for coming.